Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish happiness. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson, is going to be talking a little bit about the prevailing wage hearing that went on yesterday. Also, the Triangle Waste shirt factory fire that will be 100 years, the 100-year anniversary this Friday, I think an important moment in labor history, and a couple other things that we'll get to. Also, Ron Pollack, founding executive director of Families USA, going to be here talking about the health care bill, which today, 1 year old, I would say the sun came up today, but it was a little overcast. I know it came up somewhere. It was light outside. The earth has continued to spin. So, all those dire predictions, the end of civilization, hasn't happened. Anthony Moore, a guy who was at the healthcare rally today, the one we've been promoting for a couple of days, he's going to be here to talk about the rally. Also, Donald Cohn, a writer, to talk about his piece, The Fire Last Time. And this is about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire that killed 146 young women, burnt to death. Because the owners of the factory were worried that those women, those workers, would steal some scraps. Steal some of the scraps off the floor. So they chained the doors shut. So when the fire broke out, there was nowhere to go. People leapt 8 floors to their death, down elevator shafts. A horrible, horrible moment in U.S. In U.S. labor. Now, these particular owners, they had 4 factories burn. 4. Also, in the third hour, Jeff Johnson, president of the Washington State Labor Council. He's going to be here talking about the rallies that are going on in the state of Washington, all the way on the other side of the country, and what they're doing to kind of push back against these right-wing attacks that are going on, that are really going on across the country. So all of that, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So here it is, the first birthday of Obamacare. Here it is, the very first anniversary, and like I said, everything same as normal. It's not the end of the world. CNN poll came out today. Said 37% of the people support the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. 59% were opposed. And it's the opposed that are kind of interesting. Because if you look at that poll, you go, well, I see the majority of people want it repealed, get rid of it. 13% said it wasn't liberal enough. 43% thought it was too liberal. So what you've got then, if you really look at the numbers closely, 50% thought it, you know, either thought it's okay or didn't go far enough, while 43% wanted it done away with. So it's kind of interesting. because the meme that the right has been throwing out there is that the majority of America wants this, you know, defunded and repealed and replaced. Remember the pledge? The grand pledge? Repeal and replace. Repeal and replace. Nice sloganeering. Keating Holland, CNN's polling director, said, it's worth remembering that opposition to the bill came from both the left and the right last year, and that has not changed. Personally, and I've said this a thousand times, if I were to answer this question, I would have opposed the bill. Because, again, I don't think it went far enough. I don't know the liberal BS. I don't know if it's too liberal, not too liberal, not liberal enough. I don't know about that. I think Medicare should have been what we've gone after. Opened up Medicare for everybody to buy into, said this is how much it's going to cost. You got the option to buy into it, which would ensure that, you know, maybe we would be able to insure the uninsured. Maybe we would even save Medicare and Medicaid along the way, because it would be one program, one big pot that both the old and young are paying into. But, you know, the thing is, you know, Republicans were losing their mind. And crybaby, John Boehner, it's Armageddon. It's going to be the ruin of our country. Tricky Ricky Santorum said, health care for people? It'll destroy this country in the next year or so. He said America will have to dramatically cut the military because we can't pay for it. But we can pay for two wars. But we can pay for tax cuts for the very wealthy. We've got money when it comes to things that they want. But when it comes to taking care of children, taking care of, you know, the family, the thing that they say that they're so in favor of. Sorry, we're broke. Tom Coburn, Republican from Oklahoma, said there will be no insurance industry left. And in 3 years, nothing, all gone. Michelle Bachmann, my favorite crazy, she said on page 16, you can read it yourself. No new health insurance policies can be written once the federal plan comes into effect. I don't know what she was smoking, but Glenn Beck, here's another one. It's the end of America as you know it. It's the end of prosperity in America forever. Hannity said it's over. If we get nationalized health care, if we get it, it's over. This is socialism. And all of these people, all these dire predictions. A lot of people are going to die, said Paul Braun, a Republican from Georgia. Louis Gohmert, Republican from Texas, said, I would hate to think that among five women, one of them's going to die because we got socialized care. Virginia Fox, Republican from North Carolina, said Republicans plan to make sure that we bring down the cost of health care for all Americans. I kind of think by making sure that they can't afford it and they can't get access to it, but she goes on to say, and that it assures affordable access for all and is pro-life because it will not put seniors in a position to being put to death by their government. Oh, death panels, remember? Remember? There's going to be a board, and they're going to decide if Granny lives or dies. Remember all this rhetoric the right kept throwing out? It's beautiful. Bachmann said, oh, it's going to change the country forever. It's socialized medicine is the crown jewel of socialism. Going to change the country. Well, has the country changed? And look, I have to be honest. There's part of me that says, yeah, this law should be repealed. All safety net laws, all programs, all of that stuff should be repealed. Because then maybe when enough people suffer, when their stomachs are empty, maybe their heads get right. Maybe when there's nothing left to lose, maybe when their backs are against the wall, they're going to stand up and say, you know what? We've been getting screwed for a couple of generations now. Ever since Reagan came into office, it's been going the wrong way. There has been this well-thought-out, well-planned attack on working people. You know, there's part of me that says minimum wage, do away with it. This part of me says, safety on the job, dump OSHA. We don't need that. Dump workers' comp. Workers' comp is only for the lawyers, the doctors, and the insurance companies. The worker gets screwed no matter what. Go back to the good old days when the worker could sue the company. Unemployment, do away with that. You can get that through your union. Maximum hour laws, don't care. You can get that through your union. Maybe you see people coming back together. The problem, and there's a problem with this thought, in the perfect world, like all models, that, you know, by organizing, by collective bargaining, by sitting at the table and negotiating, we can get all those things. A decent living wage, safe jobs, unemployment, maximum hour laws, all of those things that we take for granted that labor has fought for all these years. The problem with it is a surplus of labor. That's what we have right now, a pretty massive surplus with a big unemployment rate. And even when that surplus tightens up, big business with their political clout import labor from everywhere else to drive down the wages. Remember welfare reform? Remember that when Clinton passed welfare reform? Made the right all tingly in the panties. It drove down wages. So, yeah, the radical right got to kick the single mother out into the workforce, threw her off the ADC rolls, forced her to take some crappy minimum wage job with no health care and no way to have her children watched, but just said, you got to get out there and get a job. No child care, none of that. What happened to the wages? I remember the McDonald's down the street from my house when I lived in Allentown at the time was paying $10 an hour. $10 an hour at the McDonald's. You actually had people who were thinking about, hey, this isn't a bad career. As soon as that welfare reform bill kicked through, right down the minimum wage. Why? Because you injected a large amount of labor, desperate labor. And that's what the right really wants. They want a permanent desperation class that they can manipulate against the rest of us. Which is why, if you're in the middle class, you should be promoting safety net programs. You should be promoting help for those who need it. Those folks, you know, whatever happened to reaching back behind you and pulling somebody up with you? It seems now we've gotten to this mentality that, well, I've made it. I'm going to slam the door on that person behind me. I've made it, and, you know, I'm Horacio Alger, of course, and pulled myself up by the bootstraps. I did it. They can do it on their own. And we seem to aspire, and there's nothing wrong with aspiring to be the guy in front of you, but we seem to almost worship that guy in front of us, so much so that we give him too much, that we allow him to take more than his share. And it's always saving money off the backs of, well, off the backs of workers. And if you look at the attacks that are going on across this country, and the agency French Press has an interesting article about Ohio, where they point out that the Ohio bill that Kasich rammed through and the Republicans rammed through, is pretty unpopular right now. In fact, there's a good chance that they're going to overturn this on the ballot. It's a 54-35 poll here, people in favor of collective bargaining. But one of the lines in the story that grabbed my attention, it said Ohio is one of 37 states considering legislation to curtail union rights. All because Republicans had major gains in the November midterm elections. So they see this, and look, you know, AFP reports it accurately. The midterm elections to undermine one of the biggest sources of financial and grassroots mobilization support for their Democratic rivals. That's what this is about. This is about gutting your political enemy and pushing down that working class that had a voice. And I'm telling you, folks, wake up. You know, the attacks may not be on the front page here in Pennsylvania, but workers are getting attacked here every day. And we need to right now stand up, get together, and just do little things. Like come to a rally. Like write a letter to your congressman. Write a letter to your legislator. There's a lot. Call the talk radio program. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around. We're right back after this.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Detroit Three automakers reportedly want as much as 15% of auto worker pay to be tied to performance-related bonuses rather than guaranteed annual raises in the new contract being negotiated. UAW President Bob King has said he's open to new forms of profit sharing. This would put auto worker pay at risk, a huge change in how auto worker compensation is structured. The Communications Workers of America says AT&T's acquisition of T-Mobile USA is a tremendous opportunity for improving America's broadband infrastructure. AT&T is committed to building out its broadband network to nearly every corner of the U.S. within 6 years. CWA says AT&T has a history of respecting collective bargaining, so this deal will also mean better job security and a better chance for T-Mobile workers to organize. Yesterday, Workers Independent News profiled a number of states that are currently in a fight against anti-union legislation. As we were filing our report, Alabama unions were rallying in front of the State House in Montgomery. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 100 taxpayers rallied to oppose legislation that would block workers from using payroll deductions to pay union dues to any organization that participates in the political arena. Al Henley, Secretary-Treasurer of the Alabama AFL-CIO, said the move is an attempt to silence workers.
If there were no unions, there'd be no ballots. There'd be no answer to these attacks.
Henley also attacked the priorities of legislators who give tax breaks to corporations while slashing services to Alabamans.
It's the same old game. The party in power tries to hurt its opponents. They don't care that it hurts the middle class. Folks, that's wrong. When it hurts the middle class, it's immoral.
The Secretary-Treasurer also took the opportunity to remind the media that workers are salt of the earth and keep the state running.
All you press guys, let the record indicate this is not some left-wing, tree-hugging, commie, pinko, liberal group. This is the salt of the earth, working-class Alabamians here. Yeah.
More than 450 foundry workers are striking at Pacific Steel Castings in California in a rejection of deep concessions demanded by the company. The members of Local 164B of the Glass, Molders, Pottery, Plastics, and Allied Workers Union says the concessions would cost the average worker $300 a month. That strike halted production. And Maine Governor Paul LePage is taking down a 36-foot labor history mural at Maine's Department of Labor. He's also ordered conference rooms named for labor heroes like Cesar Chavez to be renamed. The governor says the names don't fit the goal that he thinks the Labor Department ought to have, achieving pro-business goals. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
The things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
So, as you heard in the wind clip there, Governor Paul LePage is working for you to get government out of the way and allow Maine small businesses to create jobs, according to his website. It's time to get Maine working again, he says, and that means tearing down the roadblocks that establishment politicians have built over the past 40 years. And exactly how does he plan on tearing down these roadblocks that establishment politicians built? How's he going to do that? He's going to tear down this mural of organized labor history from Maine's Department of Labor building. And, you know, understand, this is the guy who beat up children to steal their Halloween candy. So this, no surprise here. But this, again, this is but one more in a long and substantial list of attacks, as well as symbolic attacks like this one on workers and their connection to what created their middle class existence. Kind of reminds me of what Rendell did before he left, moving the worker statue from the governor's mansion. Anyway, I've got our good friend Erwin Aronson on the line. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, good to hear your voice.
You know, I look at this another in a long line of attacks. 37 states are going after something that labor has. This This isn't, as the media is saying, isolated attacks. This is a well-scripted, concerted effort by the GOP.
Oh, this is a coordinated effort, a coordinated attack, and this is not an effort by the GOP. This is an effort by a group of wildly right-wing, radical, lunatic fringe players who have hijacked the GOP. We have to remember the GOP is the party of Lincoln. It's the party of Nelson Rockefeller. It's the party of Lowell Weicker. These people are not the heirs to that legacy. These people are loony birds. The offense that's happening in Maine tonight is beyond description. They're tearing down a mural to Frances Perkins, the first woman cabinet member in the history of the United States of America, who was appointed the Secretary of Labor by Franklin Roosevelt. It's just beyond description, and it is one of those kinds of things that they're doing this because they can.
All right.
But along the way, people are going to learn that when those who are elected to office hold those offices, they're doing it as a public trust, not as a private enterprise. And when they breach that public trust, the public becomes enraged by big things and small things. And while this one in Maine that LePage is doing is more symbolic than actual, it is a symbolic kick in the teeth, just as you described it a few moments ago, much the same as when the Rendell administration moved the Worker Memorial statue off the grounds of the Pennsylvania governor's residence. A statue that was dedicated by former Governor Casey, who, in the dedication ceremony, and I was there, announced that every occupant of that public house would get up in the morning and go to bed at night looking out a window that reminded him or her of exactly who he or she served. It's a terrible, terrible time.
Yep, I absolutely agree. You brought up Frances Perkins, and Perkins, the first secretary of the Department of Labor, and I think of that when, you know, tomorrow, Friday is the 100th anniversary of really one of labor's most horrific moments with the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire that killed some 146 young women. Burnt to death, thrown out of windows, falling down elevator shafts, a horrible tragedy because, well, the owners were afraid that a few scraps might turn up missing.
Exactly. It's an intriguing piece of history and, one of those kinds of things that shocks the conscience when we recognize that all of the broad-based framework of worker protective law and workplace safety law came out of the foment of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And the same person I just mentioned a few moments ago, Frances Perkins, when taking her oath as the first woman cabinet member in the history of the United States, really announced that the beginning of the New Deal was not in 1932 when Franklin Roosevelt was elected, but in March of 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist fire took place. And that was the beginning of a recognition that a new era had to dawn where government stepped in and erected a wall, if you will, between corporate greed and the rights of people who were just merely trying to earn a living. And government units, first in New York and ultimately throughout the United States and at the federal level, recognized that it was the role of government to protect people who would otherwise be victims in the workplace.
And you know, in that frame then, this idea that people had rights, maybe even over property.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the entire force of this. There had been a series of Supreme Court decisions that ultimately ended with a case called Lochner, where the Supreme Court pronounced that the rights of property holders exceeded the rights that were even guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, the right to free assembly, the right to free speech, the right to practice one's religion, even things like the right to bear arms. and the Lochner era began to end, the end of the beginning, as it were, after the shirtwaist fire in New York City on the West Side, when a recognition was made that property rights had to be subliminated to personal rights, to individual rights. And that was, from that time forward, a steady march toward a recognition of what our Constitution guarantees to all of us, until recently, when we have had this lunatic fringe that I mentioned a few moments ago taking over the people's houses. And in taking them over, they have arrogated to themselves the power to destroy what was built up over the course of a century.
And doing it very quickly, I might add.
Well, they need to do it quickly. If they do it in the same progressive, gradual way that we reclaimed our rights over a century, they might get caught. So this way, they are dismantling. They're dismantling people's rights, and in doing so, as was announced and exposed as recently as yesterday from the Senate Majority Leader and no less in the state of Wisconsin, that the real goal here is to strip people of their political rights, to strip unions of their capacity on behalf of their own members to participate in the political process, because they believe that will result in the overthrow, from their perspective, of the democratically elected government of President Barack Obama.
Let me ask you this, going back to the shirtwaist fire. You know, one of the most telling parts of all this, while this was prior to the fire, there was a major strike, some 70,000 people in the streets, you know, mostly young women, who were beaten and abused and all kind of horrific things by the city government. These people, you know, stayed course, fought for their rights. The vast majority of them got union recognition. It was this single place, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that didn't get that recognition, that ability to bargain, to sit at the table, to bargain for the conditions under which they labored. And if they had that right, maybe those doors wouldn't have been chained, and maybe those 146 young women would not have burnt to death.
Oh, I think that your read of the history and your description of it is eloquent and absolutely on beam. The owners of the Triangle Waste Company had set themselves up as sort of the agents provocateur of the day, who were going to draw the line and stand up against the otherwise growing membership in the what was at that time the new ILGW, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And historically, these two owners had decided that they were going to be the ones that didn't go along with the rest of the industry. Most of the industry in New York City by that time had entered into collective bargaining agreements. And remember, this is a period of time long before there was a National Labor Relations Act. This was a period of time when the legitimate right of unions to exist in a pluralistic society had not been established by law. It was established exclusively by the group action of people who had had enough and who were willing to take a chance to make life better. And most of the owners and operators of the garment industry in New York City had finally come to the understanding by 1909 and 1910, after the great strike of the 70,000 and two other fairly substantial actions, that in order to exist in this country, that the immigrant workforce who they had been exploiting with 6.5-day weeks and paying them a few dollars a week for their work for 12-hour days had to come around and enter into collective relationships and establish some conditions about pay, but more importantly about safety. And the operators of the Triangle Waste Company refused to participate in that, and they were really the 1911 equivalent of so many of the right wingers of today that draw a line in the sand and say they refuse to deal with unions and they will not be kowtowed and so on and so forth.
Well, as I've said a number of times, if you're not seated at the table, chances are you're on the menu.
Well said. Well said, Rick. And by these two guys, these two owners of the Triangle Waste Company building that burned, were not experiencing their first fire on March 25th of 1911. It was their third fire, third serious fire. Fortunately, the two predecessors took place at times when their plants weren't occupied. And as a result, they didn't harm human life. They just merely collected insurance proceeds. But the Triangle Waste Company fire was different. And what they had done was locked and chained the doors so that at the end of the workday, everybody had to leave through a single door and could have their pocketbooks checked to make sure that that scrap of fabric wasn't being smuggled out of their great plant. And the result of that was when the fire broke out, probably from a cigarette or a discarded match, with all the scraps slovenly kept on the floor and the oil spilled all over the floors from the operation of row after row of machines, the fire went up and there was no way out. And you described it well. Some of the young women and girls burned to death and their skeletal remains were found leaned over their sewing machines. Still others, not wanting to burn to death, jumped out of windows and hopefully into the arms or the litters of firefighters, but they fell right through those litters and jumped to their deaths. And from that terrible, agonizing tragedy came an understanding that wasn't just in the hands of the workers, but in the hands of the business owners and in the hands of great articulate leaders of a legal system, people like former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who took up the mantle, and it created a new generation, a generation whose view of the way people should be treated was guided by the result and the impact of that terrible fire, and as such created the legacy in the hands of a Francis Perkins, in the hands of an Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of the President of the United States, and so many others. And in a mere 2 years from the day of the Triangle Waste fire, the membership of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union went from about 65,000 to 70,000 members to 350,000 members, predominantly headquartered in New York City.
Wow. Last question I have for you. In looking at this tragedy, which I'm sure probably the majority of people in the country probably don't know about, how do you address someone saying, well, that was 100 years ago, that couldn't happen today? That's the history when labor was necessary.
Well, sadly, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, much of my involvement in the labor movement was spurred by my reading as a youngster the history of the Triangle Waste factory fire. Just yesterday, I sat in a hearing room at the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission representing a client in the railroad industry where no less than the Norfolk Southern Railroad, the successor to Conrail, which itself was a successor to the Penn Central, which itself was a successor to the old Pennsylvania Railroad, was announcing to the Public Utility Commission that the safety regulatory framework that their predecessors had agreed to in 1975 to require that as trains were being made up in the Conway Railroad Yard in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, a railroad yard that is more than 5 miles long and more than 100 pairs of railroad tracks wide, that is adjacent to 6 or 7 substantial communities with schools and hospitals and senior citizen centers and nursing homes and retailing and child care, daycare centers, that they no longer needed to abide by a rule that they had agreed to assure that trains wouldn't run out while being made up, trains that may be filled with noxious gases, that may be filled with contaminants, that may be filled with explosives, that may be filled with any number of dangerous, explosive, toxic chemicals, that they could mechanically superintend the making up of trains, and they wanted to eliminate the requirement that two people on a crew stand watch to assure against runouts of these trains as they're being made up, because they had technological ability to just do away with it.
And computers never fail. So it still is all about the bottom line.
Well, it still is about the bottom of workers. I don't know if it's about the bottom line. Once again, you know, this situation I just described, you two people on a shift in a railroad yard, how much could that cost? That's not about bottom line. It's because they can, because they sense that they can, because there is a sense among Republicans and Democrats alike that somehow or another the regulation of the workplace is fair game to abandon now. And when you abandon the regulation of the workplace, you're abandoning people. You're abandoning mothers and fathers. You're abandoning our children who will grow up in homes inevitably denied a parent because somebody decided regulation was no longer needed, and then the accident took place.
Well, like they say, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Irwin, I appreciate your time, brother. Our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson, thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you. And this anniversary is not a celebration, but it is a recognition of why we are who we are and why we need to do what we do.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Change is not the same thing as progress. In fact, change can be the exact opposite. It can be regressive, as we're now learning from, where else, Congress. A flock of Tea Party-infused Republicans has certainly changed the political dynamic in Washington, and exultant GOP leaders are claiming that they are now the voice of the people. But most people won't find themselves represented by this change, much less see it as progress. That's because the newcomers in Congress, whether Republican or Democrats, tend to live high up the economic ladder, way out of touch with the people they're representing. Indeed, 40% of newly elected House members are millionaires, as are 60% of new senators. While the great majority of workaday Americans are struggling to make it on about $30,000 a year and having at best puny pensions and iffy health coverage, these incoming lawmakers tend to be sitting pretty on accumulated wealth. Their financial reports show them holding extensive personal investments in such outfits as Wall Street banks, oil giants, and drug makers. Their wealth and financial ties might help explain the rush by the new Republican House majority to coddle the corporate powers. From gutting EPA's anti-pollution restrictions on big oil to undoing the restraints on Wall Street greed, they're pushing for a return to the same laissez-faire-land ideology of the past 20 years that got our country in massive messes. At the same time, they're out to kill the green jobs program, bust unions, cut Social Security, defund Head Start, and generally stomp on the fingers of working families trying to hold on to the middle-class rungs of that economic ladder. This is Jim Hightower saying, the change in Congress is taking America backwards, not forwards, for the new majority literally is the voice of millionaires, and that's not progress.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
One 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You got something on your mind, question, comment. According to the Superior Court judge in New Jersey, Peter Doyne, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's deep and drastic state school cuts have left New Jersey schools unable to provide a thorough and efficient education to the state's nearly 1.4 million school children, according to the Star Ledger. The judge, who was appointed as a special master in the long-running Abbott versus Burke school funding case, issued an opinion that found that the reductions fell more heavily upon high-risk districts and the children educated within those districts. Because, look, at the end of this, we do know that this ball is going to roll downhill, and it's going to end up on the backs of the local taxpayers. So your school property taxes are going to go up. You're going to pay more in that vein. Now, some of the poorer communities, they can't do that. There is no there. So part of this, I think, is, look, these people are in big trouble. He goes on to say, despite spending levels that meet or exceed virtually every other state in the country and that saw a significant increase in spending levels from 2000 to 2008, our at-risk children are now moving further from proficiency. Christie's office said that Judge Doyne himself acknowledged the Supreme Court limited his inquiry to the excluding consideration of the state budget crisis. And what I find interesting is now that this has come down, Christie's spokesperson is basically saying, well, you know, we're spending all this money, and, you know, money doesn't ensure good outcomes. Of course it doesn't. We know that. Oh, yeah. And that, you know, the judge needs to find the realities of our budget. And I go, I don't know that I agree with that. Do we want to have a bunch of kids who aren't smart enough to find their way home? Personally, every other avenue should be explored. Now, look, the legislature there in New Jersey wanted to put a millionaire's tax up. People who are doing really well. People who benefit from an educated workforce. People who benefit from investment in education and schools and roads and bridges and all the things that taxpayers pay for. Maybe they could kick back a little bit, or, to use the Corbett frame, contribute. Sounds reasonable to me. But the problem is you've got an entire radicalized movement in this country away from education. And I look at the Reuters story today of the three potential 2012 Republican presidential candidates who have expressed hostility toward the public education system. Now, they were at one of these homeschool rallies, but, you know, no bones about it. They attacked public education. Ron Paul said, well, the government wants absolute control. They want to indoctrinate our children. He also went on to say the public school system now is a propaganda machine. They start with our kids, even in kindergarten, teaching them about family values, sexual education, gun rights, environmentalism. And they condition them to believe in so much which is totally un-American. You know, because, you know, taking that plastic bottle and putting it in a recycling bin is totally un-American. It's a foreign concept to recycle and reuse. Totally, totally foreign concept. The fact that we should respect others, a totally foreign concept to the American psyche. Because after all, we're exceptional, remember? And I like to puff my chest out too, man, and say, you know, we're number one. We are exceptional. But I'm also rational in my critique of what's going on around us. I like to say, you know, I love my country. I do. I am an absolute patriot. I believe in fighting for what's right, fighting for the future of my family and my friends. But you got these people, man. They just off on a plank somewhere. And my favorite woman, Michelle Bachmann, was at the homeschooling rally. And she had some gems saying homeschooling is the essence of freedom and liberty. It's about knowing our children better than the state knows our children. Well, I would hope so. I would hope that parents know their kids better. I would hope parents take the time. The sad reality is a lot of kids don't have that advantage. Bachmann, who evidently homeschooled her five kids, boy, there's going to be a clam, lamented that she and her husband have been unable to teach the 23 foster children who live in their home because Minnesota authorities said foster children could not be homeschooled. She says it's barbaric, and it's a bureaucratic decision of what's best for your children. And then the best guy of all shows up, the pizza man. Mr. Kane, the talk show host, pizza guy, he says that's all we want is for government to get out of the way so we can educate ourselves and our children the old-fashioned way. And when I heard that, it took me back to a couple of friends I knew who did homeschool their kids. And to be honest, they were probably not the brightest bulbs in the box themselves, but they homeschooled, because they were Bible thumpers. They were the totem and quotem crowd. The only thing my kid needs to know is what's in the Bible. What's 6 times 9? Is that in the Bible? No. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, I asked the one guy, I said, here's the reality. I don't think you're the brightest bulb in the box. You're teaching your kid what is his future going to be like, and will my child have to take care of yours? Because you're not qualified. Now, teach them, in addition to what's being taught in the public school, monitor what's being taught. I'm in favor of that. But this idea that we could have people with barely a high school education training the next generation in a very technical world that they're coming into, to me, is dangerous, short-sighted, and disturbing. I'm going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We are back after this.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
We don't
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download our podcast there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. You know, I look 37 states across this country are going after workers' rights. Now, here in Pennsylvania, there was a hearing yesterday on prevailing wage to steal that away from workers on some bizarre claim that, oh, we can save 30%. We can save 30% on building. Yes. If that were the case, if we were able to save 30%, all of the workers would have to pay the state to work for them. They would have to work for free and then pay back. But, you know, the facts, never mind. And you look at, in Congress right now. You've got a bunch of Republicans. Jim Jordan from Ohio, Tim Scott from South Carolina, Garrett from New Jersey, Burton from Indiana, Gohmert from Texas. They introduced H.R. 1135, which basically, in its language, is if someone goes on strike and the family was eligible for food stamps in the past, because, you know, you were making low wages, and you're eligible for the food stamps. Somehow now, because Republicans hate workers so much, that this bill makes that ineligible. It says, nope, sorry, you're not getting anything, so that the companies can starve you out. Think about that for a minute. It's amazing, just absolutely amazing to me. And we seem to say, well, you know, whatever. How many people are upset about this AT&T, T-Mobile thing? The fact that we're going to see really a major, major monopoly. You're going to have two, eventually you're going to have two companies. There are three left now. You're going to have two. Because I think they're going to run Sprint out of business. I think Sprint's done. They just don't know it yet. But anyway, on Sunday, AT&T said it had agreed to purchase T-Mobile for somewhere around $39 billion. And, you know, there have been comments all over the map, and, you know, there are folks who, you know, put out their press releases. And one of the press releases that caught my eye was from this group, the Heartland Institute. They are a far right-wing group. One of the guys, his name is Bruce Edward Walker. He's the managing editor of InfoTech and Telecom News and Research there at the Heartland Institute. He said one hopes the FCC doesn't dither over the T-Mobile AT&T deal to the extent that they did over Comcast NBCU last year. In the latter instance, the FCC stalled and delayed in determination for a year in order to eke out ridiculous concessions that had no bearing whatsoever on their authority. So making sure consumers were protected, making sure that you weren't allowing a major monopoly, which I think they did anyway, that's dithering, according to them. The statement that I really found hysterical was this by a guy named Jim Lakely. He's co-director of the Center on the Digital Economy at the Heartland Institute. He said, those harping over this merger operate from a bizarre anti-business mindset. They have convinced themselves that it is the goal of every business to gobble up as much market share as possible. Isn't that the goal of business? To get as much market share as possible, to have more customers, to be able to sell more product? I mean, am I wrong? He goes on to say, just so it finally has power to abuse customers. But no merger, not even one as large as the one between T-Mobile and AT&T, repeals the corrective influence of the free market in the digital economy. In other words, no company is eager to ruin its brand, no matter how big it gets. So the logic here is that no company's ever going to abuse their standing because they don't want to because the free market will introduce new providers. Now stop and think for a second how expensive it would be to get into the wireless market, to the internet market. Think of how expensive this is, especially when you now have two companies who own all the towers. They own the network, so there aren't going to be any startups. No one's going to decide tomorrow, gee, I think I'm going to throw up some towers and start offering lower price services. What's going to happen in this, and the free market people know this, what's going to happen is you're going to have some competition here on the short term. They're going to compete. They're going to lower prices. They're going to beat each other up for a little bit to put Sprint out of business. Once Sprint goes out of business, then they start going, hey, we've got to coexist. So we're going to split up the market and we're going to raise prices. We're going to raise prices. Does anybody remember the long distance wars? Do you remember that? They were actually giving money to people to switch to their long distance carriers. And eventually the small ones, the fly by nights went away. And now what do you got? Almost the thing as you had before. Although the cell phone has pretty much done away with the long distance market because if you got a cell phone, there's no more long distance. But that's the way we're going with this. They're going to fight each other. They're going to beat each other up for a very short time. And then it's return on investment. It's line the pockets. And who gets beat up in the end? The consumer. You're going to get beat up. You know it's going to happen. And I say at the front end of this, and look, I think that this merger is a terrific thing for the workers of those companies. I think it's an outstanding thing. It's going to give them larger market share. It's going to give them to bargain for better wages, better conditions, better benefits. It's going to be terrific for the workers. And on that vein, good for them. But as a consumer, I don't see how this is going to be better for us. I think it's going to harm us in the long run. The consumer, again, it comes back to which side are you on in that question. Are you the worker or are you the consumer? So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, especially with my prediction that I think Sprint, you know, their future is already been written. The last chapter has been written. We just haven't read it yet. And, if you got stock, start looking to dump, I think. And again, I am not a stock wizard. But at the end of this, this idea, and I love the simplicity of logic, that just because they're so big doesn't mean they're going to ruin their brand. Well, who else is going to fill that void? Like I said, nobody's going to be able to start up. And that's my problem with a lot of this stuff. Once we close those companies down, once we consolidate to the point to where they are now too big, you can't go back. Same thing with the radio market. Same thing with this industry. There's a handful of behemoth corporations. There are a couple of little fringe companies, but for the most part, you're going to have two or three companies. And I go back to what you know Jimmy Hoffa said back in the 60s. Eventually, there are going to be two trucking companies. There'll probably be two companies for everything. There'll be a union one and a non-union one. That was his vision. That's how he saw things going. I just don't know that there one's going to be union as we move industry to industry. And this idea that, oh, you're going to get all these small startups, not going to happen. Not going to happen, folks. Anyway, so that's my thought on it. If you've got a thought, question, comment, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK. Also, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Like I said, if you missed any portion of the program, you could download our podcasts right there for your convenience. Also, at the website, there's some videos. Take a look at a place where you can comment. Do appreciate that. We're going to take a quick break. We are right back after this. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News, I'm Doug Cunningham. The Detroit 3 automakers reportedly want as much as 15% of auto worker pay to be tied to performance-related bonuses rather than guaranteed annual raises in the new contract being negotiated. UAW President Bob King has said he's open to new forms of profit sharing. This would put autoworker pay at risk, a huge change in how autoworker compensation is structured. The Communications Workers of America says AT&T's acquisition of T-Mobile USA is a tremendous opportunity for improving America's broadband infrastructure. AT&T is committed to building out its broadband network to nearly every corner of the U.S. within 6 years. CWA says AT&T has a history of respecting collective bargaining, so this deal will also mean better job security and a better chance for T-Mobile workers to organize. Yesterday, Workers Independent News profiled a number of states that are currently in a fight against anti-union legislation. As we were filing our report, Alabama unions were rallying in front of the State House in Montgomery. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 100 taxpayers rallied to oppose legislation that would block workers from using payroll deductions to pay union dues to any organization that participates in the political arena. Al Henley, Secretary Treasurer of the Alabama AFL-CIO, said the move is an attempt to silence workers.
If there were no unions, there'd be no ballots. There'd be no answer to these attacks.
Henley also attacked the priorities of legislators who give tax breaks to corporations while slashing services to Alabamans.
It's the same old game the party in power tries to hurt its opponents. They don't care that it hurts the middle class. Folks, that's wrong. When it hurts the middle class, it's immoral.
The Secretary-Treasurer also took the opportunity to remind the media that workers are salt of the earth and keep the state running.
All you press guys, let the record indicate this is not some left-wing, tree-hugging, commie, pinko, liberal group. This is the salt of the earth, working-class Alabamians here.
More than 450 foundry workers are striking at Pacific Steel Castings in California in a rejection of deep concessions demanded by the company. The members of Local 164B of the Glass, Molders, Pottery, Plastics, and Allied Workers Union says the concessions would cost the average worker $300 a month. That strike halted production. And Maine Governor Paul LePage is taking down a 36-foot labor history mural at Maine's Department of Labor. He's also ordered conference rooms named for labor heroes like Cesar Chavez to be renamed. The governor says the names don't fit the goal that he thinks the Labor Department ought to have, achieving pro-business goals. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
So this morning, nearly 100 citizens converged on their state capitol to have their voices heard on the health care issue since Governor Tom Corporate locked them out from testifying. So the citizens took to their capital, and I've got the school board director from William Penn School District, Anthony Moore, on the line. He was one of those citizens today that converged on his state capital to get the word out. Anthony Moore, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, no problem, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, tell me what happened this morning. What did you guys do today in the capital?
Well, today what we did was we got together at the Capitol to voice our concerns about not having our voices heard at this meeting that they were going to be having, the governor along with the other people that he was, you know, that he wanted to have in this meeting. But what they decided to do was to not allow the voices of the people who would actually be affected by the governor cutting funding to the current health care law. And, you know, so since they decided they were going to lock us out, we decided that we were going to show up and we were going to have our own hearing at the Rotunda this morning, and that's exactly what we did.
And, you know, from what I heard, it was an excellent rally. It was an excellent testimonial, if you will. Nearly 100 people showed up, which, yes, for a weekday is phenomenal.
For a rainy weekday, it was terrific. You know, we had a bus that was supposed to come down from Scranton, but that bus could not make it because of the snow. But we had people that came from Pittsburgh and from the Philadelphia area, you know, and other areas as well. So it was still well attended. And, you know, the weather was not going to stop us. This was just too important today.
So tell me what your part in this was.
Well, my part in this was is that you know, I'm supporting this. First of all, I support this bill 100%. You know, I have relatives and friends who have suffered greatly because they did not have health care. You know, and now we have an opportunity to ensure millions of people across this country. And, you know, we need to be able to do that. I mean, this is the United States of America. We are supposed to be better than that. I mean, you know, we have other countries that ensure their people. They've been doing it for years and years and years, and we are far behind the rest of the world, kind of, here. And so, you know, we need to do this, if for no other reason than to just say, look, we are just as good, if not better, than any other industrialized nation in this world.
But Anthony, didn't you hear? Didn't you get the memo? We're broke.
I understand that.
We're flat broke. There's not a dime in the budget. We can't do anything. We're flat broke.
Well, I tell you what. If there's not a dime in the budget, then why are we giving $800 million of worth of tax breaks to big business in Pennsylvania?
Well,
why is the governor doing that?
Didn't you know that's going to create jobs?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
it has done so many times in the past.
You know, and Rick, you know, I've heard this over and over again and again. If giving tax breaks to big business and to the most wealthy people in this country, if that was going to create jobs, it would have done so by now. It hasn't done it. They've talked about this before. They've done these tax breaks before, year after year after year, for the very wealthy and the very rich and for these big corporations, and still nothing. I mean, and so we're supposed to believe that now those tax breaks are supposed to actually create jobs when they haven't done it in the past. I'm not buying it.
Yeah, it's like George Bush said in this clip I've got. You know, he's being very very articulate in his George Bush way.
Mm-hmm. A robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief. We will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
So they gave out $550 billion.
Right.
$550 billion with the hope. With the hope and the prayer, oh, please, please create 1 million new jobs. So if my math, and look, I went to public high school, my math is 550 grand a job. How do I get one of those jobs? One, but the reality is they didn't create anywhere close to 1 million jobs.
Oh, I know they didn't, and they never will, and that's why they need to get off this rant. It hasn't worked. It doesn't work. And, you know, how long do they think that their American people are going to buy into this?
Yeah, but how, again, you know, people are buying into it, and this is what scares me, that the same stuff has failed, and yet the machine keeps pumping it out, and people keep buying it.
Rick, you know what, I'm going to tell you this. It's not that people keep buying it. We have an electorate that needs to be more educated and more informed. And unfortunately, in this country, who's ever making the loudest noise are usually the people that get the vote. And those are not necessarily the people that should be getting the vote. But that's what happened here in 2010. That's all that happened. You know, the Republicans got out there. They made the loudest noise. They told a pack of lies. You know, the voter not being really educated. We're just looking at the sound bites on television. They bought into it, and they went out and they voted that way. And now we've got a bit of buyer's remorse going on in places like Wisconsin and Ohio and Maine and now here in Pennsylvania.
You know, I look at all this, Anthony, and what's frustrating to me, and I think you're right. I think what it is we don't have an active, informed, engaged electorate, and it's all what's on the 24-hour spin machine on that magic box that sits in the living room. That you know, we just don't talk to each other anymore. You know, here on this program, we get people who disagree with me, and they come and they throw their talking points, but that's it. We can't have a discussion because it turns into, well, my talking point's right.
Right, exactly. No one wants to listen. No one wants to find common ground. No one wants to hear what the other side and say, well, this person may have something valid to say. Let me really listen to what this person is saying. I agree with you. That is not happening, and that's where we're losing here in this country, because we've got to be able to listen to each other and then to agree to disagree.
But don't you think that comes back down to education, the very thing that
it does.
Every one of these radical right-wing governors across this country are slashing? New Jersey, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida. We're talking deep, drastic, draconian, painful cuts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, and like you mentioned right before I came on, you know, I am one of the school directors of the William Penn School District, which is in Delaware County, right outside of Philadelphia. We cover five different towns here, and we're trying to educate over 5,000 kids here in our district. And the governor is proposing drastic cuts to, you know, to school districts all across the state. And with these cuts, we're going to be short $10 million for our district. We're $89 million budget right now. And without the state assistance, we're going to have a $10 million hole, and then we've got to try to figure out how do we fill that hole. Do we cut busing? Do we go from full-day kindergarten to half-day kindergarten? Do we lay off teachers? Do we get rid of the, you know, the basketball team and the track team and the football team? You know, what do we do?
You get rid of the union.
Yeah, right. Well, you know what? I'm going to tell you this. Our union has said that they're willing to sit down and work with us. And, you know, unions across the country have been saying, you know, they realize that we're having hard times right now. They're willing to sit down and come up with some solutions here.
Well, isn't that what negotiating is about, Anthony?
That's what it's supposed to be about. But you know what? When you want to get rid of collective bargaining, then, you know, all that goes out the window, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and it's just crazy. You know, I had one of my constituents call me the other day, and he said, you know, I just can't take another tax increase from the school district. If you guys raise my taxes again, I am going to lose my house.
Well, you send them back to Corbett and say Corbett's the reason we're going to have to raise your taxes.
It is, and you know, and that is the real reality. But that's not really something that this person wants to hear from me. They don't want to hear me passing the buck, which is what they think it is.
And that state senator you got down there, Hardy Williams, another one with his half-cocked voucher bill.
The voucher bill, you know, and I've read up on the voucher bill. The one thing that that concerns me about the voucher bill is that it does not hold charter schools and the private schools, Catholic schools. It doesn't hold them to the same standard that it's holding our public schools. And to me, that's not fair. You know, it looks at our progress, but it's not looking at the progress of the charter schools or any other schools. And then, you know, if a child gets a voucher and they go to another school, you know, who's to say that if that school doesn't do well, where are they going to come back to? Because by then our schools will be out of business.
But isn't that the plan? And I know I didn't have you come on here to talk about education, but, you know, at the end of this, I think they're linked. I think all of this is linked. All of this, this slashing of budgets, and balancing the budget on the backs of those least able to shoulder the burden. Right. Children in education, people without health care, people at the margin already, we're talking about making their lives worse.
Yes, we are. Yeah, that's exactly what, you know, what the state government is talking about, and that's exactly what the federal government is talking about. You know, it's really nice that the governor can say that he's going to keep his word by not raising any taxes, but by these cuts that he's making, what he's actually doing is he's shifting the tax-raising burden onto our cities and our municipalities all across the state. That's what he's doing. So he's saying, you know, yeah, we won't raise it in Harrisburg, but everybody else in your local district where you live will have to.
Yeah, well, like they say, it rolls downhill.
Yes, it does.
So what do you were out today here in Harrisburg. You're at the Capitol. What do you tell people in our listening area as we move forward? Because this fight isn't over.
No, it's not.
Is the opening salvo, if anything, because right. The attacks, I do believe, are going to come fast and furious, and there are going to be so many that the average person is never going to be able to keep up, which is part of their M.O. What do you tell the average person?
You know, you've got to get involved. This is not the time to sit back and just, you know, be the person on the outside looking in. Today, it may not be you, but tomorrow, I guarantee you, it will be you or someone that you know or someone that you love, someone that's close to you. You know, so we have got to get out there today. And that's what I tell people. You know, I was in California over the weekend, and I knew that we were going to be having our own function at the Rotunda in the Capitol today, and I made sure that I got back here. I flew across country. I got here last night, and I got up 5 o'clock this morning to make my way to Harrisburg. We have got to get involved.
That's what it's going to take. And I've said this from the very beginning. It's going to take people in the streets.
Yeah.
Anthony Moore, I appreciate your time. Thank you for your activism. Thank you for your support and your dedication and your fight.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me, Rick.
All righty, Anthony Moore, I appreciate your time. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Change is not the same thing as progress. In fact, change can be the exact opposite. It can be regressive, as we're now learning from, where else, Congress. A flock of Tea Party-infused Republicans has certainly changed the political dynamic in Washington, and exultant GOP leaders are claiming that they are now the voice of the people. But most people won't find themselves represented by this change, much less see it as progress. That's because the newcomers in Congress, whether Republican or Democrats, tend to live high up the economic ladder, way out of touch with the people they're representing. Indeed, 40% of newly elected House members are millionaires, as are 60% of new senators. While the great majority of workaday Americans are struggling to make it on about $30,000 a year and having at best puny pensions and iffy health coverage, these incoming lawmakers tend to be sitting pretty on accumulated wealth. Their financial reports show them holding extensive personal investments in such outfits as Wall Street banks, oil giants, and drug makers. Their wealth and financial ties might help explain the rush by the new Republican House majority to coddle the corporate powers. From gutting EPA's anti-pollution restrictions on big oil to undoing the restraints on Wall Street greed, they're pushing for a return to the same laissez-faire land ideology of the past 20 years that got our country in massive messes. At the same time, they're out to kill the Green Jobs Program, bust unions, cut Social Security, defund Head Start, and generally stomp on the fingers of working families trying to hold on to the middle-class rungs of that economic ladder. This is Jim Hightower saying, the change in Congress is taking America backwards, not forwards, for the new majority literally is the voice of millionaires, and that's not progress.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Well, so what a great song. I mean, absolutely true. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Evidently, the cuckoos at the Westboro Baptist Church, they haven't gotten enough press. They say that they're going to picket the funeral of Elizabeth Taylor, who passed away at the age of 79 today. Again, you know, this to me, I don't get it. I don't get what the maybe I get the shock value. Maybe I get the fact that, you know, they're lonely. They need attention. Maybe they're hoping somebody takes a swipe at them. I don't know. But at the end of this, these cuckoos, they say they're going to picket her funeral because she was an anti-AIDS activist. So I guess for the people who have the God Hates Fags website, that is a fitting place for them to spread their hate and insanity. So there you go. Speaking of insanity, Sarah Palin according to a new public policy polling survey, is unlikely to get a warm reception in Rhode Island because they the people there at the public policy polling survey, they went to 27 states around the country and found that the Alaska governor, you know, the quitter, her biggest negative rating comes from the ocean state there in Rhode Island, 69% unfavorable, 24% favorable. And the rest of the survey was no great news for her either. In the last 5 months of her favorability, everything's gone negative. Neighboring state Massachusetts came in second behind Rhode Island. 68% of the people seemed to not care for her. California was third, 67% not happy. West Virginia, oddly enough, was the only state where a majority didn't rate her negatively, but still 47% said they not very happy. Only 41% gave her good marks. Bottom line, as the pollster said, Palin is not a serious general election candidate for president, but she would have a serious chance of getting the GOP nomination if she decided to run, which she's being a little coy with. And I'm telling you, she's not. She wants the money. She needs the attention. She's an attention junkie. So I find that interesting. Andrew Breitbart, the crazy far-out right-winger, he's got an interesting spin on Palin's run for the White House. He told GQ that he thinks that the presidency is, well, it's beneath her because she's so superior to that office. He said there's more power in being Oprah Winfrey than being Barack Obama. It would be my goal for Palin to become Oprah and the ultimate kingmaker for the next 20-odd years, according to Andrew Breitbart. He said if he had the choice who he would choose for the 2012 dream ticket, this grabbed me, and I just kind of stopped in my shoes. Florida Representative Alan West and Michelle Bachmann. That would be pure insanity. And I would love to see it. In fact, I think no more Palin Santorum. We're going with West Bachmann 2012. I think that is, and I'm going to give him credit for that. That is the dream ticket. Another fiscally conservative Republican presidential candidate is in the news, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. Turns out he's been using the state-owned aircraft just a little bit. He's been jet-setting around the nation for his political trips. Most recently, he was at the CPAC conference there in Washington back in February. That's the Conservative Political Action Conference. He attended, you know, a bunch of speaking engagements. And, you know, who knows what else? I mean, we are talking about a Republican after all. But the trip to CPAC cost, you know, the wealthy taxpayers of Mississippi, cost them over $7,000 for that one trip. Couldn't he have gotten a ticket on a commercial flight for a lot cheaper and taken a cab? Because the reality is, you look at this, he takes the private jet, he's got to be chauffeured around, he's got to have bodyguards. That's a big expense. So while he's out racking up frequent flyer miles, just jet-setting around on the state jet, costing the state in 2010 $300,000 just that year alone, he also showed off his George Bush work ethic. Evidently, he was out of the state part or all of the time 175 days last year. 175 days, go on vacation. We're going to go here. We're going to go there. Kind of, I wish I had that job. How do you get a gig like that where somebody else pays all your bills and you can point the finger and say, well, you know, it's those Democrats that ran up the deficit. So it's Democrats that ran up the debt. Which is kind of interesting today being the day that it is, because according to History.com, in an address to the nation, the great president, the great conservative, Ronald Reagan, proposed the Star Wars program, the Strategic Defense Initiative, that cost us about $1 trillion. never worked. But one could credit that with helping destroy the Soviet Union. So he bankrupted them and, well, stole our Social Security. That now we're going to have to talk about raising the retirement age because we're not going to raise the cap because the wealthy never seem to, they never seem to have to pay into the things that they destroy and the money that we've stolen from the fund. So interesting times ahead on that front. Locally, our good governor here, Tom Corbett, would be proud of the state of Texas. You remember in his budget address, he said that he'd like Pennsylvania to be just like Texas. Well, here's something interesting. According to 2009 data from the EPA, the state of Texas alone generated over 38% of all hazardous waste in the U.S. Yeah, over 38% of all the hazardous waste in the country by one state. So you look at that, it's three times more than the second place person, which is Georgia, with a third of what Texas did. In fact, 46 other states combined still didn't reach the level of Texas. Texas had 13.5 million tons of hazardous waste that it generated. Georgia, over 4 million. Louisiana, almost 4 million. Alabama, just over 2 billion. Mississippi, almost 2 billion. You notice anything about those states? Texas, Georgia, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi. Noticing anything about that? Places where workers don't have rights. Places where the person who's doing the job doesn't have the protection to speak out on the job. So I guess I gotta wonder if this isn't in our future, as the drilling industry with their hazardous waste, does Pennsylvania ever make that list? And if so, is that a good thing? I don't think it is. And this is why I've got a real problem with this I want to be like Texas. Because I don't. The only thing I want to be like Texas in is the fact that they tax their drillers 7.5%, which was more than the Democrats proposed in the last bill back in October. Stop and think about that. So we're not raising taxes by taxing the drillers. We're not closing the Delaware loophole. We're not going to tax smokeless tobacco and cigars. We're not going to do any revenue enhancement whatsoever. Because after all, we got a spending problem. So in the process, what we're going to see is we're going to see uneducated kids. We're going to see people without health care. And I guess that's okay. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
We know those holiday bills can really pile up, hit you with double-digit interest rates, or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer, good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, leave those high interest rate balances to your PSEC Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pscc.com/life. Get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Time will change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Well, the truth of the matter is things are changing. I guess I just wouldn't say for the better. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Anyway, Friday is going to be the 100th anniversary of the tragedy that was the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And there's been a lot of stuff written, and Donald Cohen is one of the people who's written a great article, The Fire Last Time. We've got it linked over at therickssmithshow.com. Donald, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate this. What lessons would you want people to learn from this tragedy?
Well, I think it would be a couple of really important lessons. First off, organizing is critical. Before the fire, there were, in 1909, there was a strike, the uprising of the 20,000 of mostly women garment workers. The year, the following year in 1910, there was a strike of clothes makers, which were primarily men, and that there was a strong and vibrant labor movement that also included people and communities from other sectors. That was, beyond just, workers. It was both people involved, women involved in the settlement house movement, women involved in the suffrage movement, philanthropists who saw the awful conditions of work. And the first is that, a movement, it not only matters, but it's essential for change.
Right. Well, some would say that it wasn't until the philanthropists and the suffragettes got involved that the workers actually saw some gains on the picket lines, because up until that point, they were actually being beaten by police and by troublemakers.
That's absolutely correct. And that, that's a lesson that we use today in the labor movement and in community movements around the country, is that when workers are organizing, they need broad support because of what employers do. What they did then, with less, transparency, with less light turned on, but what they continue to do now when workers try to organize are, need people from the faith community, people philanthropists, people from the philanthropic community, people from the business community, from anywhere, to shine the light on the tactics of employers, which, while the specifics have changed, there are no longer locked, typically no longer locked factory doors, although it still does happen. It has happened in recent times. People are fired when they try to organize a union all the time. They're harassed on the job. And you need the support of folks outside the labor movement. as well as a very strong and organized labor force as well. No question about that.
Yeah, and as we heard in the phone call that Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker thought he was talking to billionaire David Koch, still a governor thinking, having thought of using troublemakers, using agent provocateurs to cause an uprising.
Oh, there's no question some of those things go on today. I mean, there's an enormous amount of power in corporations that want to stop a union. And some of the tactics may be a little more sanitized than they used to be, but not very much.
Let me ask you this.
Go ahead.
Let me ask you this. Were you surprised? Because I'm just utterly shocked that snippet of the governor responding to who he thought was billionaire David Koch saying, why don't we send in some troublemakers? When he responded, you know, we thought of that there wasn't a massive hue and cry and a massive call for his head.
Yeah, pretty remarkable, isn't it? Pretty remarkable. You know, I wish I could explain that. He said it, and I, of course, I listened to the tape, and he said it sort of as a matter-of-fact way, but for media purposes, you know, sort of messaging in the modern American media decided it wouldn't have looked good. That was the only thing stopping him at that point. But you're right, the fact that he's even considering it without, you know, sort of a, you know, broad outrage is really quite remarkable.
Because it's one of the lessons that I, you know, in my reading of this horrible tragedy, 146 young women either burned to death or leaped to their death or fell down the elevator shaft. That's one of the lessons I took from the entire thing was, you know, that these women were being beat up regularly and arrested regularly.
They worked under terrible conditions. I mean, those doors were locked. You know, just right there, right? The doors were locked because they wanted to keep control of the women from taking breaks or stealing, you know, scraps of fabric. And so, you know, I don't think you have to go much further than that. I don't actually know that in terms of the triangle, whether women were beaten or not, it was just grueling long hours in oppressive circumstances.
Well, on the picket line, you know, the research work that I've seen on the picket line, you know, going to what Walker had to say, you know, there were people hired by the company to go beat these women up. And when the women, you know, defended themselves or fought back, they were arrested.
That's right.
We're talking horrible stuff.
And it's that's exactly right.
I think it's stuff that workers today need to understand where we came from and given Walker's comment, where we could easily go back to.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, and there's another one I would sort of draw your attention to, is a second lesson, perhaps, from the Triangle Fire. I mean, one of the things that we talked about in the article that you mentioned and some of the background research that we did, we looked up what manufacturers, what the owners of buildings, what the owners of bakeries and canneries said when they were trying to prevent the reforms that were passed after the fire, because there was such an outcry to do something about, you know, unsafe working conditions. And the employers said exactly what they say today. If you make us, force us to do mandatory fire drills and unlock doors and water sprinklers and fire escapes, and provide clean drinking water and toilets for our employees as a matter of government regulation, then our businesses will flee and jobs will be, you know, in today's term is what would be called a job killer, that, you know, the Republicans and the Chamber of Commerce and others are calling job killers. So, the lesson there is, no matter what, every step of progressive, you know, law, whether it be organizing a union or whether it be passing a law to protect workers or to protect communities or protect the environment, has been fought tooth and nail by this outlandish rhetoric that, you know, the sky will fall if, in fact, you make businesses, you know, clean up their act. And that's exactly what we're seeing today in the House of Representatives. Darrell Issa's committee, when he came in and chaired he's the chair of the Government Oversight Committee, sent out letters to 170 employers and employer associations and folks like the Chamber of Commerce and say, asking, tell us what so-called burdensome government job-killing regulations you want us to get rid of. And they came back with a list that would, you know, they want to be able to poison. They want to be able to hurt workers on the job. It's modern issues, but it's the same story.
It's the same basic story. And, you know, it frustrates me when I hear someone say, well, you know, the unions that you talk about, you know, we needed those 100 years ago, but today things are civil. Things are good. How would you respond to that kind of, delusion?
Well, I think, you know, in a couple of directions. One is that, you know, the extraordinary transfer of wealth that we've seen in the last 10, 15 years is really quite something. That, you know, our economy is, you know, there are people who are getting wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And as the economy grows again, it was growing before the Great Recession, and now it's growing, starting to grow again, all of the gains of that growth are accruing to the folks on the top. And what's happening to working families, working people, whether they're low-wage workers or middle-class workers, working families, they're getting squeezed. Their, you know, wages are not going up, income's not going up, costs, healthcare costs are going up for families, tuition costs if they have kids going to college are going up for families. And so you're seeing a growing gap and a growing squeeze on the middle class. But we live in a pretty wealthy country still, despite the, even in the face of the Great Recession. So first is the only way people get a fair shake in an economy is that they have power to negotiate over the spoils of their work. And so that's incredibly important to unions. If without unions, we have the growing inequality that we see today, and it's fairly massive. The second thing I would say is there really are, you know, people are dying every day on the job in America. That's, you know, from accidents, and people are dying every day from illnesses that they've contracted on the job, exposure to chemicals and a variety of other things. There are people who are simply living, you know, with injuries like carpal tunnel disease or tendonitis from, you know, repetitive motion injuries from people at keyboards or construction workers or poultry workers. There's enormous issues on the job today that if you don't have a union representing you, there's no way to address because you don't have the power and you don't have the structure.
Right. And taking this back to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, I would say having the ability to bargain for conditions, which is, had these folks had a union and been able to bargain for conditions, those doors probably would not have been chained, and those 146 young women would probably have survived that fire. And I look around the country. I look at Ohio, for instance, and Wisconsin. One of the things they want to take away from public sector workers is the ability to bargain just for that, for the conditions under which they toil.
Yeah, it's quite outlandish. And you're exactly right. There were demands. You know, the Triangle owners held out in the strikes before the Triangle, and they never went union. They were, you know, very hardcore anti-union owners. But those are exactly what part of the demands of some of the strikers in the years leading up to the fire there. And there are still issues today. And, you know, and they don't have to be necessarily, you know, there are issues from what I was referring to earlier is repetitive motion disease from, you know, from poor workstations if you're a clerical worker. But it's also, goes to things like family flexibility. Families that, you know, have two working parents and kids going to school and who get sick, need sick leave, they need vacation, they need a certain amount of flexibility just to, you know, meet their family's needs while still being a productive worker. You need a structure to be able to negotiate that, or else it's just at the whim of the employer.
Right. You know, I'd like to say that we could go to a time where maybe only one parent would have to work and you would have one that could stay home with the and raise the family, if you will. And I'm not being sexist one way or another because, you know, my wife stays home. Personally, I wanted to, but she just didn't make enough money. But it would have been nice. You know, I would have loved to stay home with my kids.
That's right. Well, you know, I do some work with folks in Canada right now. And, you know, the fellow I'm working with just finished his rental leave. He shared it with his wife. It was a year of rental leave where they could spend the first year of their baby's life not having to worry about work. At least one of the parents not having to worry about work. This is Canada we're talking about, a fairly productive nation.
You know, and what gets me is the people who would fight that the hardest, the people who would be vehemently opposed to that kind of family value, are the people who wrap themselves in family values.
Yeah, so, well, you know, the folks that, you know, the banks and large corporations and the folks that, you know, and the folks that the Chamber of Commerce represent and the, you know, they'll say anything or do anything. They really just want to make more money.
Sad, sad stuff. So as Friday comes around, do you know of any memorials, any actions that are going on around the country?
Yeah, I mean, not offhand, but I get emails every day. There are tons of memorials and actions and events and all across the nation. You just Google Triangle Fire and you will find there is a Triangle Fire coalition in New York. Cornell has a very good sort of center of, you know, website which describes, you know, what's going on around the country. There's quite a lot. I would assume every community, Philadelphia had one earlier this week. I know. There's quite a lot. And, you know, I would, you know, urge your listeners to do, to act, you know, or to get engaged with what's going on in their communities, but also to, you know, write a letter to their editor and say, this is what happened in 100 years ago, because of inadequate laws. Well, today we still have people dying on the job and we need stronger laws.
Excellent.
That save people's lives and help communities. And so that would be the, you know, the best legacy of the people that died in the fire would be action. To make our workplaces even safer than they are today.
Excellent, excellent points. The article is "The Fire Last Time" by Peter Dreyer and Donald Cohen. You can get there. You can read the article at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Donald Cohen's name; it'll take you right there. Donald, I appreciate your time and a wonderful article on a horrible topic.
Yeah, I mean, if I could add one thing, this article came out of a project called the Cry Wolf Project, where we look at what industry says over and over and over again to stop progressive reform. And we have a blog up now, crywolfproject.org, and we'll be building that out over the next year.
Crywolfproject.org. We will make sure that we follow that up and have you back on the program to talk about it.
Super. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Today, back in 1932, the Norris LaGuardia Act was passed, restricting injunctions against unions and bans the use of yellow dog contracts. Now, again, you know, this is one of those things, one of those themes we keep hearing people talking about. I've been saying this idea of liberty of contract is coming back, where an employee, because we keep seeing this, oh, I should have the right not to join a union if I don't, I should be able to make my own deal. again, I think, you know, we could be moving in that direction where, under yellow dog contracts, for people who don't know, if you're hired on to a company, you're a new hire, they, on day one, they slap a form in front of you for you to sign, that says you are not a member of a union and you will never join a union. And it is binding, and it used to be binding, where if you signed that, and you said later down the road, I would like to be a member of the union, they said, we got this little piece of paper, and then you were fired. And if you didn't sign it, you didn't get the job. Kind of one of those, you have a choice, starve or don't. So I think it's kind of interesting the direction that the right, and it's, and as Donald Cohn said, a lot of the rhetoric that we hear during the Depression and prior, you know, any regulation, any infringement on my ability to do business and my property rights, that's gonna kill jobs, it's gonna harm business, and it's amazing to me that we haven't, as a society, said no more. And during the election, when people kept saying, well, we need more business-friendly people. We need to be more business-friendly. Scott Walker saying, you know, Wisconsin's open for business. Basically saying you can come and trample over our citizens and rob and pillage. Now, look, I'm not going to say all corporations are bad. But at the end of it, they've all got the same motives. Cut costs, raise profits. So if they have the ability to cut corners, they have the ability to cut wages, they have the ability to take away health care and pensions and do some, well, you know, some corner cutting, if you will. There's an incentive there for that. While at the same time, what you're seeing government, the only body that can oversee them, being neutered. So if you don't have anybody watching the store, are you surprised when the shelves are bare? You shouldn't be. But that's where we've come from. And again, I guess, you know, history repeats itself. We are moving back towards this idea. And I hear it often. I shouldn't have to join a union. Back to liberty of contract. Back to yellow dog contracts. Also, in this day in 1970... 5 days into the post office's first massive work stoppage in the 195 years, President Nixon declared a national emergency and ordered 30,000 troops to New York City to break the strike. And what's kind of funny is, you know, they sent the military, they sent these troops in to sort and deliver the mail. And these guys didn't have a clue. I would have loved to have seen it. You know, because like any job, you throw somebody in, say, do it, you're going to have problems, especially something like delivering the mail. The settlement came just in a few days. So, interesting. So when Scott Walker said he was going to call out the National Guard, this is what this whole thing was for me with Nixon. He called out the soldiers to do the job of the post office. They don't have a clue how to do that. The military is to blow things up and kill people. They don't know how to do customer service or deliver mail. Same thing Walker was saying. Well, you know, if those state workers go on strike, we'll replace them with the National Guard. So we'll see the National Guardsmen up in front of the classroom with full military regalia teaching children. Personally, I think that might be a little bit comical. Now, you look at what's going on in Ohio. And Kasich, I got to tell you, this guy is just completely off his rocker. Last night we talked about the fact that he wants to sell off the Turnpike and the state liquor stores to a corporation that he set up, Ohio Jobs, that will be privatized. And he'll be the chairman. He's chairman governor, or governor chairman, however you want to put it. Taking assets from the state, selling it off fire sale style. Now it turns out he has a plan to cut prison staff, leaving some of the guard towers unmanned at one of the maximum security prisons that just happens to be located near two schools. And it's in the residential neighborhood of Lucasville, Ohio. Now, to get rid of the eight towers, to get, you know, to close that off, cost about $2.1 million. What I find interesting is this proposal was balked at by Republican Terry Johnson, a representative there in the state, who just happened to remember the 1993 riot, where a guard and 10 inmates were killed. So he's going, wait a second, I'm in favor of, you know, stealing from those workers, but I think it's probably not a bad idea to keep more people in the guard towers. So it's interesting stuff. Also in Wisconsin, for our Wisconsin update, you got to love this. There are 19 recall efforts against 16 candidates. And, you know, you go down the list of some of the Democratic senators that these groups want to recall. Mark Miller has three recall efforts filed against him. One by the name of Committee to Recall Mark Miller. And the other two committees are named American Recall Coalition. And just to save you a bunch of time of listening to me read all these people's names off, it seems that everybody's being recalled by this American Recall Coalition. And what I find kind of funny is you go down in the article and go, well, who exactly is the American Recall Coalition? Well, according to the article from the Wisconsin GAB report, board members of this American Recall Coalition hail from Utah, Idaho, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Tennessee, and Georgia, with their home office in Salt Lake City, Utah. Now, if you remember, the knock against those 150,000 people who showed up in the Capitol in Madison were that they weren't local. These are out-of-towners. These aren't real Wisconsinonians. The people who are doing the recall efforts against the Democrats, they don't seem to be any of them from Wisconsin. This, to me, again, to me, seems like one of those Koch brother front groups, one of those, here's some money, go cause some trouble. Just a thought. In fact, they want some money. You can go give them some money at aprcus.org. They're signing people up for membership, $24, $50, and $100 levels. So if, you know, things are tough, you can throw in $24 to help them, right? Amazing stuff. And, you know, I can't make this up. That's what scares me. And the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media, they're not going to touch any of this stuff because they're bought and paid for, too. So at some point, I'm hoping that we turn off the idiot box, that we start talking to each other again, and we begin to say, you know what? We can have a better future. We can have a better tomorrow. We can, have a future for our children. You know, like I said last night, if they win, they simply win. But if we win, we survive. It's that simple. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Greg Johnson. Stick around.
With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Detroit 3 automakers reportedly want as much as 15% of auto worker pay to be tied to performance-related bonuses rather than guaranteed annual raises in the new contract being negotiated. UAW President Bob King has said he's open to new forms of profit sharing. This would put auto worker pay at risk, a huge change in how auto worker compensation is structured. The Communications Workers of America says AT&T's acquisition of T-Mobile USA is a tremendous opportunity for improving America's broadband infrastructure. AT&T is committed to building out its broadband network to nearly every corner of the U.S. within 6 years. CWA says AT&T has a history of respecting collective bargaining, so this deal will also mean better job security and a better chance for T-Mobile workers to organize. Yesterday, Workers Independent News profiled a number of states that are currently in a fight against anti-union legislation. As we were filing our report, Alabama unions were rallying in front of the State House in Montgomery. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 100 taxpayers rallied to oppose legislation that would block workers from using payroll deductions to pay union dues to any organization that participates in the political arena. Al Henley, Secretary-Treasurer of the Alabama AFL-CIO, said the move is an attempt to silence workers.
If there were no unions, there'd be no balance. There'd be no answer to these attacks.
Henley also attacked the priorities of legislators who give tax breaks to corporations while slashing services to Alabamans.
It's the same old game the party in power tries to hurt its opponents. They don't care that it hurts the middle class. Folks, that's wrong. When it hurts the middle class, it's immoral.
The Secretary-Treasurer also took the opportunity to remind the media that workers are salt of the earth and keep the state running.
All you prize, let the record indicate this is not some left-wing, tree-hugging, commie, pinko, liberal group. This is the salt of the earth, working-class Alabamians here.
More than 450 foundry workers are striking at Pacific Steel Castings in California in a rejection of deep concessions demanded by the company. The members of Local 164B of the Glass, Molders, Pottery, Plastics, and Allied Workers Union says the concessions would cost the average worker $300 a month. That strike halted production. And Maine Governor Paul LePage is taking down a 36-foot labor history mural at Maine's Department of Labor. He's also ordered conference rooms named for labor heroes like Cesar Chavez to be renamed. The governor says the names don't fit the goal that he thinks the Labor Department ought to have, achieving pro-business goals. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and from the red. Father, son, left a cameo, blue dental, head is vape. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Also, if you want to email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com, you got a question, comment, something on your mind, that's the way to do it. You know, 37 states across this country are working in some fashion to steal rights away from workers. And in most of those states, I would say all of those states, people are taking to their capital and having their voices heard. Now, the mainstream media, the corporate-controlled for-profit media, not covering it. That's why I think it's important to go around the country and find people who are going to their capital, citizens beating on their door saying we want our voices heard. That's why I've asked Jeff Johnson, president of the Washington State Labor Council, to come talk to us about what's going on out in Washington State. Jeff, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, you bet, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, as I point out, 37 states, we're seeing legislatures, governors going after workers' rights in one way or another, and people are fighting back. And I think this is what labor has needed for the, well, at least since Reagan was president.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In my over 30 years in the labor movement, I've not seen us this riled up, this revved up, and organizing both within our own community as well as in the larger labor movement and with our community allies. In the state of Washington, even though we've got a Democratic governor and Democratic House and Senate, we have some of the same attacks you're seeing in the Midwest and other states. We have bills in there that would repeal collective bargaining rights for state employees, for those workers who work on the ferries. We've got ferries are part of our transportation system out in Washington State. We've got bills that would prohibit workers from competing for jobs that would otherwise be contracted out by the state. We have an attack on our worker compensation system, which is only one of four in the country that is publicly run, and which, as a consequence, is one of the lowest cost systems in the country with some of the best benefits. So we're in a world of hurt.
Yeah, with that, just the workers' comp thing, that is a huge windfall for whoever can get their paws on that.
Oh, you betcha. You know, it's an $11 billion trust fund right now with that many assets in the system. We fought, the labor movement fought back a initiative by the private insurance companies who are not allowed to practice worker comp in the state of Washington. We fought back an initiative last fall. 60% of the public voted down privatizing our system. And now the business community is back with some conservative Democrats and Republicans to basically create a system called compromise and release, where injured workers are basically starved into compromising away their statutorily statutory benefits, take pennies on the dollar, and leave.
Welcome to Pennsylvania.
There you go.
Yeah, we've got the phantom job, phantom wages, where they make up a job for you, and then, gee, you know, there's a job out there for you. You're just not getting it, so we're going to take the wages away from you.
There you go. 44 states have compromise and release. We're one that doesn't. And, Rick, the thing that makes us different than most other states, workers pay in our state into worker comp up to 30% of the total premium. So we've really, you know, we own part of the system, right? Yet still they're trying to take our benefits away. Yeah. So, basically we've done three major rallies so far with our community allies, and we're coming up on a week of action, April 2nd through April 8th. Every single day of that week, we've got major actions. The first one on the 2nd is up at the Peace Arch Park at the border with Canada and Washington State. And so we're co-sponsoring a rally with the British Columbia Federation of Labor, the Oregon AFL-CIO, and the Washington State AFL-CIO, basically bringing thousands and thousands of trade unions from both countries to you know, create this international rally that we are one, that we are one labor movement, we are one people, and you have to put people's needs first. You have to build those values into your budgets and your revenue streams.
You know, do you think we will really be one? Because one of the things that I've been calling for years since the split up with Change the Wind is this reuniting of the labor movement, because I don't know that you can fight each other and take on corporate America at the same time.
You know, I hear you, Rick. I totally agree with you. I hope it is. You know, I'm reading this book by Michael Honey, and it's Martin Luther King's speeches to labor, and the name of the book is called, you know, All Labor Has Dignity, right? And, you know, one of the things that, Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King said, you know, right before he was murdered, he said oftentimes, he said that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice, right? But we know he wasn't talking about laws of physics. He was talking about it takes labor and the community coalescing together, and we got to bend that arc down towards justice. It doesn't happen by itself. And so I think the only way we're going to get out of this mess, out of this this greatest recession since the 1930s, out of this distribution of income and wealth that's more unequal than any other country in the world, is by labor and the community aligning together and demanding justice. So we're going to have to recreate a people's movement in this country, and I think labor has a strong role to play in that. And to do that, labor itself has to come back together.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. We took a trip out to Wisconsin during the heart of the occupation, if you will, where the people, you know, thousands of people slept in their capital and stayed the entire time. In fact, we broadcast from inside the capital during that. What I was shocked by was the lack of media coverage outside of just a small area. There were no national coverage, no CNN. In fact, one of my favorite signs said, thank you, CNN, for telling me what's on Twitter.
Wow.
Because that's the extent of the reporting that went on, if there was any at all.
No, it's appalling. I know, I've just recently elected president of the Washington State AFL-CIO, and I've been pulling together our labor communicators and progressive, you know, the progressive part of our media, beginning a dialogue on how we how we get our story out to our own members, dig deep into our own members, and then in the wider public. You know, in the Seattle area, 100 years ago, we had 70 labor newspapers. Now, of course, we have one called the Northwest Labor Press that has a circulation of 5,000, and our union retiree organization has probably the best labor newspaper, and it's got a circulation of 1,500. You know, we just can't get our stories out there, so we've got to get very creative about how we do this so that we give working people real news, real analysis, real solidarity stories, because when you give them the real stuff, you can get them to act.
Absolutely, and what you've got to somehow be able to do is undo what 40 years of moneyed interests have done to the working people of this country, which is some sort of what I've called Stockholm syndrome. You know, workers have been beaten and beaten and beaten into submission that now somehow, because of the constant drum beat of messaging in their head, they now identify with their captors, and now we That's want right. governments to run like businesses.
Exactly. Oh, my God. That's right. You're right. I mean, we've been beaten so far into submission that we act like victims, like we actually caused the crisis that we're in when we know it was billionaires and bankers, right?
Absolutely. You know, I did a thing the other night where I said, you know, some idiot here in Harrisburg went into a bank, said he wanted to open up a bank account, gave two forms of ID, and then robbed the bank. And I said, you know, where are the good bank robbers? Where are the Dillingers? Where are the pretty boy Floyds? And I've come to the conclusion that they're the CEOs, because it's a lot easier to rob a bank from that position than it is evidently being dumb enough to give two forms of ID.
That's incredible. What a great story.
But, you know, this isn't the first time I've heard that either, which is kind of funny as well. So to come back to this, because I do think here in Pennsylvania, there's kind of a lull because we're not under attack as openly as Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan and Florida, and you could name the state. We're not openly under attack, but I'm saying to folks, look, our grandfatherly looking governor is just as dangerous as Walker or Kasich, and probably more so because we've been lulled into this, oh, he's not coming after us.
Oh yeah. No, you're right, Rick. I mean, you know, in Washington state, which has, you know, been a progressive state for a long time and ruled by Democrats. I mean, we're one election away from Scott Walker in the state of Washington, right? And like I say, there are all the anti-labor bills, introduced into our legislature. Most of them are not going anywhere, though some have some legs. But yeah, another election cycle, a bad one, boom. We are Wisconsin out in Washington state. And we have a set of Democrats in both our Senate and House. They have nicknamed themselves the Roadkill Caucus. So you can tell they have self-esteem issues, right?
Yeah.
But basically, what they're doing is they're aligning themselves with the Republican caucus. And in our Senate, there's a critical mass of them that they have actually flipped control over to the Republicans a couple times so far this session. You know, we're afraid that they're going to do that over the budget. We got a $5.5 billion deficit right now. Our state employees already ratified a contract where they've agreed to a 3% cut in pay, 25% increase in their healthcare costs that they pay. This Roadkill Caucus has a bill in that would abrogate that agreement so that they could reach down and dig more out of public employees. It's just insidious.
It is insidious. Well, let me ask you this, and maybe I'm going to get you into trouble here. I don't know. You know, I look at this all across the country. I looked in Wisconsin where the public sector workers were saying, yes, we want to give back. And Ohio, the public workers saying, yes, we will be willing to give concessions. Here in Pennsylvania, the teachers union and the college professor union said, yes, we're in favor of wage freezes, even before getting to the bargaining table. And I'm saying, is that the right thing to do? Even before you go, hey, there are people who are doing really well, the people who have robbed the bank. Why don't we ask them for something?
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. In fact, this week of action that we're doing from April 2nd to the 8th, the major theme is that we've already sacrificed, okay? Now you got to go to the bankers, the insurance companies that caused the problem, and show us their sacrifice, right? This state, I'm sure it's not unlike many others, we've got 567 tax exemptions on the books. Okay, that accounts for $13 to $15 billion a year in uncollected taxes that could be collected. Many of those go to billionaires and go to the corporations. You know, and there's not a damn bit of proof that any of them are producing jobs. You know, so what we're calling for is a moratorium on those tax exemptions for 3 years. Let's collect that revenue. Let's make sure that we're not kicking people off of health care. We're not loading up our classrooms with 35 students, that we're not laying off home care workers, so on and so forth. You know, let's have a moral budget. Let's, in that three-year period of time, hopefully the economy comes back, revenues come back, and then we can take a serious look at, do these exemptions, are they worth continuing or not? So we got to see some sacrifice from the folks who brought us to this disaster.
So you're one of those people who thinks that we have a revenue problem. Did you hear? We're broke. We've got a spending problem.
No, we don't spend enough. We're not even coming close to meeting the needs of our people out there. So, no, we got a revenue problem.
Right there with you. Real quick, you know, I've been pounding on this for the longest time. It's the reason we went to Wisconsin. When these attacks happen, I believe people have to get out in the streets. They have to fight back and stand together, much like you guys are doing out there and in many of the 37 states that are under attack. And I give you guys credit for it.
Thank you, Rick.
Jeff Johnson, president of the Washington State Labor Council, AFL-CIO. I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Change is not the same thing as progress. In fact, change can be the exact opposite. It can be regressive, as we're now learning from, where else, Congress. A flock of Tea Party-infused Republicans has certainly changed the political dynamic in Washington, and exultant GOP leaders are claiming that they are now the voice of the people. But most people won't find themselves represented by this change, much less see it as progress. That's because the newcomers in Congress, whether Republican or Democrats, tend to live high up the economic ladder, way out of touch with the people they're representing. Indeed, 40% of newly elected House members are millionaires, as are 60% of new senators. While the great majority of workaday Americans are struggling to make it on about $30,000 a year and having at best puny pensions and iffy health coverage, these incoming lawmakers tend to be sitting pretty on accumulated wealth. Their financial reports show them holding extensive personal investments in such outfits as Wall Street banks, oil giants, and drug makers. Their wealth and financial ties might help explain the rush by the new Republican House majority to coddle the corporate powers. From gutting EPA's anti-pollution restrictions on big oil to undoing the restraints on Wall Street greed, they're pushing for a return to the same laissez-faire land ideology of the past 20 years that got our country in massive messes. At the same time, they're out to kill the jobs program, bust unions, cut Social Security, defund Head Start, and generally stomp on the fingers of working families trying to hold on to the middle-class rungs of that economic ladder. This is Jim Hightower saying, the change in Congress is taking America backwards, not forwards, for the new majority literally is the voice of millionaires, and that's not progress.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the world, their lines.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So it's been 1 year since the passage of Obamacare. And you know what? The earth is still spinning. The sun comes up in the morning, sets in the evening. All of the Armageddon scenarios that this is the end of the world, I guess, haven't come true. Here to talk about the Affordable Care Act and what it does do is Ron Pollack. He's founding executive director of Families USA. Ron, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So it's 1 year old today, and again, like I said, the sun came up.
Yeah, but guess how many people went to death panels? Not too many.
Yeah, and you know, I got to be honest. I was hoping to get on one of those, and it turns out there aren't any.
Yeah, well, I was hoping to get an appointment to one, but it didn't work out.
Okay, so no death panels. What is it, the bill?
For the provision of health care coverage for their workers, those tax credits are as high as 35% of the costs of covering their workers. Early retirees are getting greater ability to get coverage because businesses have been given some help to provide coverage for those between 55 and 64 years of age. Community health centers received a whole lot more money. They had anticipated that they would serve 18,000 people this year. With the additional money, they're going to, I should have said 18 million people this year. Now they have the ability to serve 29 million people this year. Insurance companies no longer can rescind a policy when somebody gets sick. Insurance companies can no longer place a lifetime cap on how much is spent for the care of people. So if they have a catastrophic illness, they could be bankrupted. Now they can't have a cap, a lifetime cap. Insurance commissions in the 50 states have received additional money so that they have a greater ability to review premium rate increase proposals by insurance companies in their state. And as a result, a number of insurance companies that wanted to increase premiums by a substantial amount were told to go back to the drawing board, and many of them rescinded or lowered their proposed premium increases. So there's a lot to be very thankful for with respect to the legislation that's already in effect.
Yeah, but it's still socialism, right?
Well, not exactly. Ultimately, what this does, and this goes into effect in a few years, we will have new marketplaces, and private insurance companies will offer their coverage through these new marketplaces, and people will now have a website where they can go to get reliable information about what's in the plan, what you have to pay for it, the benefits, out-of-pocket costs for deductibles and co-payments. So this actually is going to provide significant new customers actually for the private insurance industry, but the private insurance industry is going to have to behave in a way that holds them accountable and that stops some of the practices they've had for many years that are harmful to people.
But isn't that one of the knocks against the plan, that it's mandating that people get health care coverage from private insurers or from these exchanges who, like here in Pennsylvania, one of the governors, you know, suing to overturn the health care law is going to be in charge of setting up the exchange for this state. So, you know, I don't know that it's going to be all that great with a guy who doesn't believe in it setting it up.
Well, you're making a very important point. There are a number of governors around the country that have been critical of the Affordable Care Act and even have joined in the litigation against this individual responsibility provision that requires somebody who can afford health coverage to obtain it rather than shifting the costs of their care to somebody else who has insurance. I think we're going to see good implementation of this statute because ultimately it's not a smart thing for a governor to turn this down. This the plans that are going to be arrayed in this new private marketplace now come along with the provision of federal tax credit subsidies for middle-class families and for moderate-income families. It's 100% paid for by the federal government. And as a result, the governor and the state will have lesser costs for charity care, say, through their public hospitals. So I think this is actually going to be a really good deal for states around the country, even for the states that have governors that have opposed the legislation.
Let me ask you this. You know, a lot of the really, really good stuff doesn't come about until 2014. And, you know, I've been saying that maybe this is too far down the road. I know we're seeing polls that are coming up. The more people learn about what's in it, the more they're accepting of it. But do you think the push-off date that far has harmed the acceptance of this bill?
Well, you make a very good point. You know, until you really can feel, taste, or see what the benefits are for you,
exactly,
you might be subjected to, you know, a lot of the mythology that has been discussed during this very contentious debate. On the other hand, I want to say to you that it's very important that this be implemented well and effectively. And it takes a while to create these new marketplaces and to get these tax credit systems in place. And ultimately, I think people will accept this legislation and really feel good about it if it is implemented effectively in a way that helps them. So it does take a time to make that happen. And unfortunately, it still leaves a lot of people not knowing how they will be affected by the legislation. But in time, they will know. And assuming it is implemented effectively, as I believe it has so far been, I think it's going to result in very popular acceptance of the legislation.
I hope so. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're at Ron Pollack, founding executive director of Families USA, their website, familiesusa.org. You can get there from our site at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Ron Pollack's name. You know, I look at one of the other parts of this that I don't know, and maybe you're gonna inform me, but holding down costs seems to be one of the most important functions of this. Can you explain where the savings are? Because as I understand it, and maybe I'm wrong, we're still not negotiating for prescription drugs under Medicare Plan D.
Well, that's right. There are a number of ways that I think we're going to moderate costs. Now, as you know, costs have just grown essentially exponentially. They've grown certainly much faster than inflation, much faster than people's compensation. So there are a number of ways that the Affordable Care Act addresses this. One of them I mentioned, and that is that the insurance commissions in the 50 states have been given more money so that they can examine proposed premium increases to see whether they're reasonable or not. And it has already resulted in insurance companies scaling back their proposed increases. So that's one thing. Secondly, in the Medicare program, which the federal government fully pays for, there have been a whole number of ways that savings have been achieved. The pharmaceutical companies are required to provide $80 billion in rebates over the next 10 years. Insurance companies that provide private insurance through the Medicare program have been receiving 14% windfall payments that they should not have been getting. That's being scaled back. That's going to save close to $130 billion over 10 years. The hospitals are now going to be paid based on quality of care rather than quantity of services, and that's going to create greater efficiency. So all those things are very important. There is a provision that's already in effect that requires that insurance companies spend at least 80 cents of every premium dollar on health care services for people rather than spending a larger portion on CEO compensation, administration, marketing and advertising, and profits. For those that are larger plans, they got to spend at least 85 cents out of the dollar. But I think one of the key ways that costs are going to be moderated is that this legislation tries to create coordinated care so that people will get much greater efficiency of care. If I've got multiple health problems and I'm seeing a number of different doctors, one doctor may be prescribing a medicine for me that may actually aggravate another condition that yet another doctor is treating. Now we'll have a better coordinated care system, and it means that we'll have teams of healthcare providers providing care for us. That should improve quality of care, and it should improve efficiency.
Well, let me ask you this. Why have costs grown so much? I've been saying it's because we've moved to this for-profit model that's made me getting sick a windfall for insurance companies, hospitals, doctors, Wall Street. Is this bill taking that incentive away? And some of it I think you answered there, but could you expound a little bit?
Well, now that we're moving away from payment for quantity of services and more for quality of care, that's a big deal.
So, like, if someone gets an infection, they get there's no payment for a staph infection or sepsis or any of that.
It's per procedure that is provided by your physician or other healthcare provider, and so there's every incentive to provide more, even if it has marginal usefulness to you or it has no usefulness to you. Now we're going to be moving towards a payment system that's based on quality of care rather than providing incentives to provide more and more services, even to the extent that those services are of marginal usefulness.
Last question I've got for you. In moving forward, the Republicans, they keep talking about defunding it. I don't think this has really gotten off the ground yet. Personally, I was a big fan of single payer. I thought we should have opened up Medicare for everybody, and we had the framework, would have been a lot simpler. But the Republicans now are saying we're going to defund it. They're going to tie the purse strings. Does this get off the ground moving forward with the exchanges and everything that comes in 2014?
They're not going to succeed in defunding the Affordable Care Act. You know, they may succeed in getting the votes they want in the House of Representatives, but it's not going to succeed in the Senate. And in any event, President Obama would never sign such a law. He would veto it. So that's not going to happen. This is really part of a political process. As Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, indicated, his top 1, 2, and 3 priorities are to make sure that President Obama is a one-term president. Well, this is part of that political process. He is trying to undermine in every different way he can this legislation, but that doesn't mean they're going to succeed. They won't succeed. And meanwhile, the Department of Health and Human Services that's run by Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is doing a remarkably effective and timely job in getting these provisions moving forward and working with the states so that they can make the decisions about implementation. So I think we're going to see this law in effect. As I mentioned, key provisions already are in effect and are working well. The other provisions will be effective in a timely manner.
All right, Ron Pollack, founding executive director of Families USA, familiesusa.org. I appreciate your time, sir. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you again.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We can handle it.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. And now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., I've got Ben Martinez, Talk Radio News Service. Ben, thanks for taking time for me.
No problem, Rick. How are you doing?
Good. What's going on in D.C. tonight?
Well, today the president returned from his Latin America trip. He ended in El Salvador and left a few hours early to return back to the United States, where he's been taking some ongoing criticism over his policies in Libya, namely on his inability to kind of point out exactly what the United States' mission is in that region. One thing that he's been criticized over is that he's been contradictory. Speaker John Boehner came out today and wrote a letter to him criticizing him of being contradictory, and he pointed to the fact that the administration's original desire was for Muammar Gaddafi to step down. But at the same time, the administration and President Obama are supporting the UN resolution, the United Nations resolution, that doesn't call specifically for a regime change. This is one of the things that he's been criticized over, not only by Republicans on the Hill, but by Democrats. And to quote one Democrat, Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, came out today, and he said that he was going to bring up an amendment that would bar using federal money to fund military operations in Libya. And, Rick, I'll tell you that one of Kucinich's motives behind bringing up this amendment is that our actions in Libya are actually costing quite a bit of money. One figure I'll bring up to you and your listeners is that, because we're having to solidify the area for a no-fly zone for the coalition to come in, we're having to expend a lot of our Tomahawk missiles. The first day that we engaged in Libya, the United States deployed more than 100 of these Tomahawk missiles. Now, it might not sound like a big number, but each of these Tomahawk missiles cost between $1 and $1.5 million. So the first day alone, we rallied up quite a pretty big tab as far as just firing missiles are concerned. So that's one of the big criticisms that he's faced so far.
Well, for me, the biggest criticism is he didn't go to Congress, and I'm sorry. I've come to the position where if you're going to put our troops in harm's way, there is a process, and I think he should have known better, and I think he should have gone that route. I understand the argument on the other side as well, but I still think at some point we've got to pull that power back just a little bit.
Sure, sure. And Rick, I'll add to that in saying that this whole criticism of President Obama that he should have gone to Congress, and I will say he should have gone to Congress. He should have had the authorization from the full House and from the Senate. But people that would go the latter, do the opposite of that criticism would say that he did go to Congress. He spoke to congressional leaders. He spoke to Speaker Boehner. He spoke to Senate Majority Leader Reid. And they would bring up that there's a doctrine that was passed in 1973 called the War Powers Resolution, passed after Vietnam, saying that exactly what your argument is that the president needed to get the full authorization of both houses in order to proceed and deploy our military into hostile regions. But one thing that's not mentioned is that specific doctrine also allows for the president to make a unilateral decision and then gives Congress between 60 and 90 days, I believe, to then, you know, take up this offer and, you know, authorize it or not authorize it. So right. I think that's what's happening here.
Well, and, you know, I'm in favor of that, but here's the thing. This guy, and I'm a supporter of President Obama. At the end of it, he was supposed to be different. He was supposed to be the anti-Bush. And this is something I would have expected Bush to do.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there were criticisms earlier saying that by deploying the United States military into Libya, he was not only making the same mistakes that George W. Bush did, but also the same mistake that Clinton did in the Kosovo situation. So it's kind of like, you know, there's that whole saying that history repeats itself. I mean, this is only evidence to that. You know what I mean?
Yep. And what's the other big story in D.C. today?
Well, another big story in D.C. today is the fact that it is the one-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. And, you know, the debate's going to go on. It's going to continue. It kind of went dormant for a while after this unrest in the Middle East started sparking and started taking control of the news cycle. But because of the anniversary, you know, this whole repeal health care, you know, it's come back up. And, you know, the Republicans they've come out in their pledge later in 2010 in their pledge to America saying that their number one goal would be, if they took control of the House, would be to repeal Obamacare. And, you know, they've taken steps to do that. You know, the 1099 provision for small businesses, you know, that's been challenged. And now they're contemplating whether to bring up legislation to offer states waivers from the mandate. So that's also going on, and now there are more criticisms coming from Republicans, and you know, specifically again, Speaker Boehner, he has his guard up. He's not backing down, and I'll quote him. He says, "We will do whatever we can to ensure that Obamacare is never fully implemented." And you know, I would not doubt that you'll be seeing some pieces of legislation in the near future that will work towards that goal.
I got to tell you, I would make this a major campaign issue, saying, you know, you 54 million people who don't have health care, that guy over there, the guy who cries a lot, he's the reason.
and you know what? A lot of people might agree with that. And something interesting is that in the past 2 years, there's been debate over health care. Is it good or is it bad? Well, we're going to have to wait and see until some of its provisions actually take place. And that debate is going to continue until 2012 because the majority of the provisions in this piece of legislation don't go into effect until 2014.
Right.
So, you know, basically when polls, you know, new polls have come out and they've essentially showed that the overwhelming majority of Americans have still unchanged views as far as healthcare is concerned. Obviously, small businesses were deterred from the legislation because of the 1099 provision. It was tedious, they worked on that. And I think repealing the whole bill in total is just that's ridiculous. I think if they move forward and they pick apart the little pieces of it, after all, it was a 2,700-page
yep.
piece of legislation. If they take closer looks at it and look at the effects that each provision is having and, you know, make some little tweaks, I think in the end it's going to be a great piece of legislation and it will make its mark in history.
Now, I've said from the beginning, this is a step in the right direction. Personally, I was a single-payer fan. I wish this had gone much further, opened up Medicare to everybody. You've got the framework there. I think that would have been fine, but we didn't do that. So this is a step in the right direction. By no means the finish line. Ben Martinez, I appreciate your time. Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, brother.
Thanks, Rick.
And now from Harrisburg, Governor Tom Corbett, according to the AP, says he opposes the drilling tax, but he's going to look into allowing local communities to have fees. Kind of makes you go back to this idea of, you remember the whole unemployment compensation thing? Didn't see that as a tax, saw it as a contribution. So I guess what he's seeing here is he doesn't want to tax the Marcellus Shale, which every other state in the country does. Even the one he seems to idolize, Texas, has a 7.5% drilling tax. He's against that, but you know he might be willing to have some communities and counties impose fees to deal with the impact of them coming in and raping our lands. And what's amazing to me is we've had a couple of historical moments where we go, we know where this is going to end. You know, you remember the oil boom in Titusville, Pennsylvania, where they came in, found oil, raped the area, and left the people there to clean up the mess. Remember the coal industry that came up, you know, Scranton, all the way up that way, raped the land. In fact, one community is still on fire and left. I say if we don't get in front of this, if we don't get a share of it now, we're never going to, and we're going to be left with a whole lot of mess. Also, the Patriot News is reporting from Harrisburg. A Dauphin County judge today dismissed a handful of criminal charges against former Republican State Representative John Purcell and Brett Fries in the so-called Computergate case. Judge Richard A. Lewis refused to grant blanket dismissals of the charges against Purcell's affiliate Fries of Lycoming County and 8 House Republican caucus staffers. That means the 10 remaining, according to the Patriot News, of the 10 remaining are on track for trial on theft, conspiracy, conflict of interest, and other charges. That'll happen, I guess, in September in a pretrial motion. Lewis dismissed 2 conspiracy charges from among more than 80 criminal charges filed against Purcell's by the state's attorney general's office. The judge also dismissed 4 of more than 60 charges against Fries. The Republicans are accused of using millions of dollars of taxpayer funds and publicly financed computer services to support political campaigns. Again, that whole bonus gate thing, that whole thing that the Democrats got nailed on and nailed hard. Republicans, not so much. It will be interesting to see how this plays out. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we live. Rick Smith.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is a place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional product. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
I'll be honest, every time I hear this song, it frustrates me because there was a glimpse, there was a moment, a brief moment, a fleeting moment where I thought maybe possibly could happen that we would pass some labor law reform in this country to make it easier for workers to stand up and have a voice on the job. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is now this is completely flipped around, and it's nothing but a tax on workers' rights. It's nothing but a tax on the very limited, very weak labor laws that do exist. And it's an attack on, well, it's an attack on labor. It's an attack on workers coming together. It's an attack on collective bargaining. It's an attack on unions in general. And you look at in Texas, House Bill 2986, that bill calls for making it illegal for any union to lobby on behalf of its members. So if the members have a problem with workplace safety, training, workman's comp, prevailing wage, any issue that may come up, they cannot participate in lobbying. Are you getting this? It's all about neutering. It's all about taking the voice away. You know, kind of reminds me of the mafia. They just come in and whack out your tongue. You won't talk anymore. That's what they're trying to do to us. And here in the state of Pennsylvania, all of these bills are there. All of this divisiveness is right there, but it's underneath, it's subtle, it's underneath the surface. You got a governor who during the budget talks said, well, you know, as long as, you know, paraphrasing, mind you, as long as they agree to what I want, I won't attack them. And we seem to be happy with that. And personally, I'm of the mindset we need to be defending on every front. So yesterday, the Pennsylvania State House Labor and Industry Committee, chaired by a Republican guy named Ron Miller, held one of what will be three hearings on, you know, issues of what they call great import, one of them being prevailing wage. For me, the whole prevailing wage issue is very simple. It comes down to a couple of very simple points. Do you want to have a local, skilled construction labor force? Do you want to have people in your community who are able to build the things that your community need? And if you do, you've got to pay them a reasonable, fair, local valued wage. Because that's what the prevailing wage is. It's the wage that's paid in the area. It's the prevailing wage. We're not going to take the lowest wage. We're going to take the one that people are paying. So, and mandate that. So you can't undercut. You can't have transient labor coming in. You can't have fly-by-night operations coming in undercutting, even though they never do. So when they put this out there that you can save 30% on a school building project if we just steal from those workers, because they're willing to work for nothing anyway, especially if we bring them in from Mexico. Now think about this. They say that on a building project, you can save 30%. So that's the number I've seen thrown around an awful lot. Basically, in a nutshell, labor costs on most building projects are about a quarter of the total costs. The other stuff are bricks and mortars and architectural fees and you know, a whole litany of other fees. The people who actually put the puzzle together, they make about a quarter. So in order for that project, that entire project, to save 30%, those workers who make up a quarter of that, they would actually have to pay money back to make up that 30%. It's impossible. The math just doesn't work. And, you know, I went to public high school. You know, I learned math, you know, on a piece of paper with a pencil. So I did. I sat and figured this out. So it's false on its face. Now, I don't speak for anybody but myself. I would be in favor of saying, okay, if you say it's going to save 30% of the cost, let's look at the history of the bids that have come in and make sure that the future bids are 30% less than the past bids. So if you built a school in one part of the county and it cost cost $1 million, now with the 30% savings, it costs $700,000. And my question is, how many contractors would do that? Well, we already have the information, and the information is none. Back during the Ridge years, when they tried to do this, the bidding process, when they dropped the floor, actually went up. It actually went up. So they were stealing from workers, and the bids actually went up. So what happened to that money? Oh, yeah, it went into the contractors' pockets. And that's the thing we've got to remember here. Prices aren't coming down. You're going to pay for it one way or another. It's just who gets that piece of the pie. The pie is going to stay the same. It's just redistributed differently. And I say when you give out those slices, I think the working people should get our slice of it. Because that generates a local economy. We don't want a transient labor force. We want a local, we want a trained, highly skilled local construction craft. Because the buildings that they build, they live here, man. Their kids sit underneath the roof that's on that school. Their kids play on the playgrounds. Their kids are in those buildings. Their spouses are in those buildings. They're in those buildings. So at the end of this, you want local people who are going to take interest in their local community. Somebody who's transient here for the job, man, they don't care what they do. They don't care what they pollute or what they poison. They're out of there when they're done. So for me, this prevailing wage issue is another one of those smoke screens to steal away hard-fought gains. And, you know, the Republicans, they've got their little tinky tanks, like Matt Brulé, 30%, my behind. Don't buy it. Don't buy it. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests for being here tonight. Great program. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to therickssmithshow.com, download our podcast. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind, something bugging you, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails. It may take me a day, but I do get to them, so I appreciate it. And thanks for being here. I want to thank our producer, Brett, for moving the sliders and twisting the knobs. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, infinite.